Sequoia presents Class of 79.
Some of you may have figured out we're not home yet. We're only halfway there.
What?
Mother's interrupted the course of our journey.
What?
Yeah. She's programmed to do that should certain conditions arise. They have.
Like what?
Seems she has intercepted a transmission of unknown origin. She got us up to check it out.
A transmission? Out here?
Yeah.
What kind of a transmission?
Acoustical beacon. It repeats at intervals of 12 seconds.
SOS?
I don't know.
Human?
Unknown.
Thanks for tuning in to Class of 79 on the Fangoria Podcast Network, where we take you behind the scenes of our favorite movies that turned 40 this year. I'm Natasha Pacetta, your host and vanguard of the vault over here at Fangoria, and this is our series on Alien. Our first guest in this series is Academy Award winner Roger Christian. Roger served as the art director on Alien. Roger shares how he utilized the lessons he learned from set dressing the Millennium Falcon in Star Wars on the Nostromo, fulfilling H.R. Giger's request for a pile of human bones, how rock band The Who inspired the alien egg membrane effect, and much more. But before we get to Roger's stories, I want to tell you about Fangoria Magazine. In 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. It's been 40 years, and Fangoria is better than ever, each issue bringing you 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horror's past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online ever, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. Head to Fangoria.com to learn more and to subscribe. And while you're there, make sure you enter the promo code CLASS of to save 15% off your subscription. Subscribe by August 30th to ensure you start with Volume 2, Issue Number 5, which covers Shudder's new Creepshow series. That's Fangoria.com, promo code CLASSOF. I'm also really excited to tell you guys about Satanic Panic. Fangoria's newest movie, Satanic Panic, starring Rebecca Romijn and Jerry O'Connell, hits select theaters and VOD on September 6th. Sam, a pizza delivery girl at the end of her financial rope, has to fight for her life and her tips when her last order of the night turns out to be high society Satanists in need of a virgin sacrifice. Directed by Chelsea Stardust and written by Grady Hendrix, Birth, Movies, Death calls Satanic Panic an absolutely entertaining horror film that will satisfy any viewer's need for monsters and mayhem. See it in select theaters and VOD September 6th. And I want to tell you about our Alien series sponsor, Titan Books. Titan Books has recently released The Making of Alien by J.W. Rinzler. To celebrate the movie's 40th anniversary, author J.W. Rinzler tells the fascinating story of how Alien evolved from a simple idea in the mind of writer Dan O'Bannon into one of the most memorable sci-fi horror thrillers of all time. With brand new interviews with Ridley Scott and other key members of the original production crew and featuring many never-before-seen photographs and artwork from the archives, The Making of Alien is the definitive work on this masterpiece of popular cinema. The Making of Alien by J.W. Rinzler is now available in bookstores and online retailers everywhere. Now let's get to Roger's stories from his time working on Alien. You won an Oscar for Best Production Design on the original Star Wars movie. You designed the interior of the Millennium Falcon and were tasked with designing the interiors of the Nostromo as well. What experience from working on the Millennium Falcon did you take with you to the Nostromo?
Because of very little budget on Star Wars and having to invent a way to make particularly the Millennium Falcon tattoo and everything look aged and used, which was our kind of mantra for the movie, to try to give it a new used look. I'd invented this technique of breaking down airplane engines and parts and getting all of the pipes and switches and different pieces that you never know what they were, and PVC drain piping. We've got telephone exchanges. We were breaking down old ones that were closing down, anything like that, to stick in the walls to try and create that kind of submarine bomber look, so that it looked real and with repeating patterns, so it looked real. It wasn't just stuck on the walls. We had to do it in an engineering style. So that whole and it meant I could afford to do it because I could buy airplane scrap for nothing in those days. So that was a bit of a crossing my fingers on Star Wars because I didn't know if it worked. I suggested the idea and kept going with it. And in the end, yeah, the hold and the Millennium Falcon cockpit. They looked amazing, just so real. Everybody kept coming around looking at them. And there was definitely that kind of correlation that Ridley, I know, he'd shown the crew who were in charge of creating Nostromo. He'd shown them Dr. Strangelove, and I said, I want it like this, like a B-52 bomber.
Mm.
And they couldn't understand. And he said, you know, I want it covered like hair. Poor designer came to me and said, what does he mean like hair? And I said, he wants it completely covered in switches and piping and everything. So it's encrusted like we did in the Millennium Falcon. And so when I came on board, I just went and bought masses of junk again. And I took with me my two dressing props because I had to, you know, they're used to putting furniture and putting up curtains and dressing cups and things. I had to teach them how to, with tools, break down jet engines and assemble all the parts into composite numbers so they're the same. So you could do repeating engineering kind of like patterns.
That's so smart.
So I took the two main, guys I taught, Joe Dipple and another one, with me to Shepperton. And they then got stuck in with, well, what happened was Ridley was kind of wanted Sigourney Weaver, and the studios were obviously wanting a star, and they allowed him to do a test sequence. So instead of a plant and a white wall, which is normally how they do with actors,
right,
he asked if we could build a section of corridor. So I did that and dressed it like I did the Millennium Falcon, but in the style that Alien wanted, which was a much more, what Ridley called a space truck.
Right.
And that kind of base green, that army green kind of color, we made that. And that's where he did his screen test for Sigourney, but it also screen tested the look of Alien. And so as soon as they saw that on rushes, it was signed off and we just got to work dressing the rest of the... It's a nightmare, actually. So much work in little time. Both these films were way under budgeted for what they should have been.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at Alien, I mean, it was made for $5 to $7 million, maybe?
Yeah.
And that's like nothing. Yep. Even back then, it was nothing for the scale that they wanted.
Absolutely, yeah. It was, I think, $6 million. And not long before we started, Fox cut $600,000 out of the budget.
Oh, man.
And of course, where does that come out of? The art department, because there was no other big fees on the film. So sets were going out the window that we couldn't do, but we still found a way to sneak some in.
Another thing that I really like about the interiors of the Nostromo, you made it look very lived in. There's coffee cups.
Yes.
You know, there's just normal everyday things strategically placed there. Can you talk about why this was so important?
Yeah, it was, two things. One is, you know, the idea of the Nostromo, when you first go in, it was like the very famous story of the Mary Celeste, which was a ship found abandoned with no crew on it.
Right.
I thought that, you know, a good way to show that this is not just an empty ship is these people would have been on and having cups of coffee and smoking cigarettes, and in those days everyone did, and put around familiar things that people would be using on a normal journey. And I think both Star Wars and Alien, before that, you know, most science fiction films were really sterile, and that people had this idea that everything would be plasticky and no detail and kind of future looking. Well, that's not the way I would approach it, and not the way that I saw it. And particularly with Star Wars, that was always my idea, and George's coincided with that, that we wanted a used look, something that an audience wouldn't question. And I think, you know, and I always say on Alien, we got it right. I think, you know, everyone said, wow, that looked like you've gone and found the space tug, and that would have been used so many times. You've just gone in and filmed in it. As
right.
I said, that was, for me, the triumph of what we did and the success of it, because I think the crew members as well fitted into that environment beautifully. Everything was an organic whole, and that's very important, I think, for an audience to believe in what they're seeing, not to question it. But when you see these plasticky kind of looking sets that are on purpose designed futuristically, and then the guns that go beep, like little plastic guns, nothing is real, you know? No one believed it. I did before this.
And I think that speaks to Ridley's vision, too, of wanting to make the Nostromo completely interactive and practical, like all of the lights and the boards had to actually work so the actors could interact with them and play into that illusion that, yes, this is real and they've been on the ship for a very long time and they all know each other and they're at home here. Can you talk a little bit about what your role was in just making everything functional and walking the crew through how to interact with your sets?
That was a nightmare. After we'd done the piece of corridor, of course, my boys got stuck in, you know, and I kept explaining to the producers, you know, you can't buy two jet engines. I had to buy 20. We had to buy huge truckloads of scrap because it eats it up. And it also, you have to warn people, it doesn't look very good until you get to the final layering and then you start to paint it and put on aging and oil.
Right.
Then it starts to work. So they got stuck into that. I then got handed the bridge to do. I also followed Ridley's idea. I wanted, like, if they switched a switch, a light would happen. Something would go on rather than just, you know, the usual flicking and pretending.
Right.
So I had Nick Alder's special effects department gave me three guys, and all they did was build switch panels, and then the electricians got those, and because they were, I don't know how many, 50, 100, by the time we did all the corridors, the infirmary, the bridge, the cantina area, by the time we'd done all of those, there are switch panels everywhere, then the upper and lower levels. So they just made up panels using all these massive boxes of switches we got in. And then the electricians didn't do all of them, but in areas where we knew the crew would be doing functioning switches and things, they did that. And I'd also bought in some amazing, the seats are from jet aircraft at the time, the scrap. We brought them in. And Nick Alder then engineered those with, they could slide backwards and forwards remotely, which the actors love. They could move them in and out. So we did all of that, you know, and then I knew they were going to have the fire when they were going down. So I got little fire extinguishers, and we put those in and painted them the right color. And there's a lamp called a redhead, which is actually a film light, which I thought was really nice. And we got four of those. I got from the electrical department, and we stuck those above the seats. Everything was done by look. And, you know, we geared up helmets to stick in there. And I had a prop maker I'd hired on Star Wars who'd never done it before. It was a new role and it was special props. So like I could make up a lightsaber, he could make another three for me.
Right.
So I took Roger Shaw with me onto Alien, and he would take motorbike helmets and I'd give him scrap, and then he'd make them into kind of what looked real helmets for the crew to wear in emergencies, things like that. So we really encrusted it, and especially the bridge, because I knew they were going to spend more time in there, and that had to be the crowning achievement of the Nostromo. And Ridley was shooting in anamorphic lens, so it was widescreen, and he always wanted that claustrophobic look. So he drove the designer and the poor construction manager man, because they'd finish and then he'd say, no, lower the ceiling more.
Oh,
he came
geez.
In with a camera and was right. I think it was lowered six times till it got down, till it came into the shot on the very wide angle cinemascope lenses. And you needed claustrophobia is a very big part of Alien.
Right.
And in fact, the test corridor that was made, they had Ron Cobbett design rough sketches of it, and it had portholes, and that was the one thing that didn't look right from the test corridor.
The
so they were taken out. Yeah, forget the windows. As soon as you can look out, you're not enclosed anymore.
Right.
And that was really necessary for the Alien drama.
Oh, definitely. I think, you know, it is a very claustrophobic movie, and that just adds to the tension all around. And it's such a scary movie, and the perfect combination of sci-fi and horror. And I think a lot of that has to do with Giger and his vision. And you worked closely with Giger. What were your initial reactions to seeing his paintings for the first time? And what was your relationship with him like?
I knew his work, obviously, the day that I was caught down, because they'd already started Alien. I was on Life of Brian and about to go to Tunisia, and the film got cancelled. The financier deemed it was blasphemous. So that within 3 hours of it being cancelled, Ridley called me and said, get down to Shepparton now, I need you. And when I went in the office, there were Giger's original paintings several round the walls. And I mean, it's like going into a hallowed shrine for somebody who does love sci-fi, you know, because I knew the paintings from books, but there they were. And I mean, they're just, there it was. There was the alien colors, everything. And he was very kind of anti-film, Giger. Very, you know, he was an artist, a pure artist. So he deemed to come. And he was only coming for 2 weeks to Alien. He said, I'll just come and have a look and see what everybody's doing. And I don't think he expected much. And when he saw what was going on, he stayed the whole shoot. And that was my first thing, because being the dresser, I had to get everything that people wanted and everything. So I said, what do you need, HR? And he said, bones. I need bones.
Oh, my gosh.
So I said, okay.
Human bones?
Yeah, human bones.
Oh, my gosh.
So I knew where to get them, because we'd done it before, you know, for scenes in films. There are certain, they're very dangerous bones, but there are, because of anthrax, it's a disease you can get from them, but they're medically prepared bones. They're used in, you know, hospitals and training and doctors.
Right.
So I got a whole truckload of bones. And Michael Seymour, the designer, had put up some flats from the sets and made him a kind of shed inside the studio. So in there, I tipped all this huge pile of bones. So most of the crew wouldn't go near it. I mean, I was fine. They wouldn't go near him.
Wow. It's so funny how you just become unfazed by requests like that. Oh, can I get a pile of bones? Sure. I'll have it to you tomorrow.
Okay. I get it tomorrow. And he wanted clay and modeling tools and all of that, which, you know, they're standard. I got all of that for him. And he was making, you know, the mothership, that huge set. He did in miniature. He was doing it with bits of bones and making mock-ups of the sets and how they would be and things, so that they were at scale. The funniest thing with him, we went, there's a pub in Shepparton, the King's Head, and we had no time. I mean, I never finished a meal at home at night. I fell asleep. It was 7 days a week grind. So we would go to the same pub and order the same thing almost every day. We just had an hour. He would come. He's so funny. He would, and his girlfriend, he would say, what is this Spotty's stick? And we'd say, well, that's a pudding. It's currants and this. Oh, what is toad in the hole? And we'd have to translate English pub food for him. He was more amused by that than anything, I think.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. He worked on the sets, you know. He was helping with spray. He would ask. He used to work with a airbrush.
Oh, wow.
And he would, he'd come on the sets and airbrush detail and stuff to help get things better.
So he got into it. You know, he probably was hesitant at first, because, like you said, he was pretty anti-film. But it sounds like he really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, he was very much a big part of it. And, you know, he would just work. He'd come in the mornings and work, either in his hut or on the big mothership set. He was there with airbrushes, helping to finish it all, everything. He was involved in making sure that kind of look and pattern and the colors that he was you know, so used to that were his colors, basically. Everything he did were in those kind of tones. He was bringing that into the film.
That's amazing. Yeah, and it looks so great. It really does. And
yeah,
you wrote a whole book about your experiences on Star Wars and Alien. It's a fantastic book. It's called Cinema Alchemist, and I would suggest everyone listening to pick it up and read it because it is just fascinating. And there's a story that really caught my eye because it was about one of my favorite bands, and it was about The Who. And they somehow tangentially helped inspire the alien egg membranes. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was in Shepperton Studios. The Who used to rehearse. They hired one of the stages and rehearsed for, I think it was one of their first tours ever. And there was a designer called Anton First, who was a friend of mine, and Anton was developing holograms before anybody else, and he was starting to get them to work, and he was using lasers to do it. So I knew Anton, and I knew I'd seen him somewhere when driving in the car park. It was one of those innocent conversations. Hi, how are you doing? He said, oh, I'm on the stage with The Who. We're doing laser stuff. He said, come and have a look. So I went in the stage, and there were laser beams firing. I'd never seen them before. This was new. And I said, these are amazing. And then and I said, can they form a membrane like that when they're going over? He said, yeah. And I said, Anton, do you mind? Can you ask The Who if they mind if I bring Ridley here? So Les Dilley and I took Ridley over there and showed him the membrane. Because we didn't know how to do the egg, the coating over the eggs, because there's no CGI in those days, you know. Nowadays it's easy. There was nothing then. You had to kind of rotoscope or do it by hand. And there it was. And they said, yeah, this will work on film, because Anton knew film. And so that's how it happened. And they spread that greeny laser, and in a certain position, it would make a membrane like it right across the floor of the set. And then Ridley put smoke into it, then it really lights up. As soon as you see the smoke, then it becomes a solid kind of beam. And that's how it did. And then when you get people dropping through it, you know, you get all those amazing shapes that happened on Alien. So that's how that came about. It was a pure accident.
That's so cool. I love that. I just love knowing, you know, one of my favorite bands was kind of involved with making, you know, one of the greatest movies of all time.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, they were great, The Who. I mean, we watched them all the time.
Oh, I'm so jealous. I love The Who. Let's talk about the weapons in Aliens. You were in charge of creating the weapons. What went into designing Ripley's gun and the flamethrowers?
So those, in those days, the set decorator, nowadays it's all split up, I think. But in my day, I had to cover everything. Guns, weapons, robots, vehicles, the whole lot came under the set decorator. So part of it was guns. And of course, Ridley said, he'd love the guns on Star Wars because I use real guns. I never made one. It was all practical working guns that I stuck bits on and made again a real look. And they're also heavy, so actors weren't pretending. They were actually holding them like real guns. So there were three things I had to do. There was the prod for the alien, which we used a cattle prod.
Oh, yeah.
So we used a welder, and we stuck a piece of metal into the roof, hidden, and then the arc welder end of the bar, when it touched, it caused all those sparks. So I made that up out of the same. We just dressed some bits on it. Ripley's gun, I did with Nick Alder, because I said, Nick, I got to do the same thing. So we found what we loved was just a real gun, the big one, and then we added pieces on it. And the last one was a flamethrower, because I said, you know, to Nick Alder, who's a genius, Nick, and I said to him, these have got to fire down the fence. and they've got to go a long way, and we've got to be able to control the flame. We can't have actors in there getting killed. And he said, well, I've always wanted to do this one way that I've got. He showed me this flamethrower, and a flame like shot further than anything I'd ever seen. I said, this is amazing. So he said, okay, well, I'll use that, then you dress it up. So I just dressed my usual, what George called greeblies, which was sticking bits of found objects onto guns or onto things, and we created it like that. So they, again, they were very organic. They weren't like, oh, let's sit down and design something and then how do we make it? No, we use found objects and dress them up so that they look the part of what would exist within a Nostromo.
It all works so well, and you're right, it all looks organic. And I love that you were talking about earlier how you just don't question this world inside the Nostromo, and you really don't. When you're watching it, you're not like, there's no part in it where you're like, this is a movie, you know, you're totally sold on it.
That was my biggest always the question. I wrote about it in the book one day, that the Ridley suddenly said to me, you know, they've got to make a note. Like, what can I use? A notebook? Can you find me a notebook? And I went off the back of the stage, thought, what can I do now? And he wants it in 15 minutes. How can I make a notebook? And as I walked around the back, the continuity lady was stripped out the old Kodak S70 Polaroid cameras. And she took out the pack that held the Polaroid film and threw it in the waste bin. And to me, it went in slow motion as it went down. And my hand went straight in, pulled it out, said, this is fantastic. You've got more of these. He said, yeah. I said, give me the box. I'll come and buy you some more. Don't worry. And I took them, rushed to my office, cut some graph paper, found a pen. We've got a stock of unusual stuff because I put pens for them around on the desktops and things. I found the most appropriate-looking metal pen I could find. And I quickly stuck the alien symbol on the top of the Polaroid clip. It's like a little metal clip, and it had little tiny spring-loaded mechanism. Mm. And it looked fantastic. So I just took it on the set, really went, oh, great. And it went into the shot.
Wow.
So it's like thinking on your feet and trying to, you know, I always felt I would fail if something didn't fit. You could put the wrong cup and saucer into a beautiful set and it would ruin it.
The details are so important, and you know, I hope everyone goes back and watch Azalien to see some of this, because it's all strategically planned by people like you, Roger. You know, these are things that aren't just there by accident. Nothing in a movie is an accident. It's all thought out, and sometimes, you know, in 15 minutes on the set. But every detail counts, and you really made every detail count in Alien. And I'd love to talk to you about the infirmary, the scene where they're doing the analysis on the dead face hugger. What were some of the practical objects that went into the creation of the face hugger?
Well, again, I got my buyer. I said, please get me loads of medical instruments. And I got all sorts of medical stuff from hospitals so that they looked whatever I chose. I found the ones that these could work within the environment. And then the face hugger itself, you know, that he had to be analyzing it, that had to look real.
Right.
It was a combination of kind of oyster pieces, and it was stinking. I mean, on sets, if you've been on a film set, and I'm sure you have, the lights and it's hot and everything, and it was very hot that summer in the stages. And of course, being Britain, we never had air conditioning in those days. It just didn't exist. So. But they were oysters and pieces of offal or anything that looked real, so that when he lifted it up, that's a piece of a kind of oyster.
Ooh.
And it's real. It was absolutely real, you know. And that when like a clam, you know, clams go on and they start feeding. So, it had a basis within how would this be real? How would this work? So, we did it like that. And then I got all these tubes. I drove my buyers mad because I'd always be saying, find me scrap tubes that are flexi that I can go in and out, and we did, and then adapted them. We found little tiny saws, all sorts of things from surgical instruments. So they were all from the right source, as it were. And then when you put them into an environment that is created, like we created it, then it all works.
That's amazing. It does. And yeah, I cannot imagine the smell of that seafood medley face hugger on set.
It was not pleasant, but there you go.
Do you have just a specific memory from your time working on Alien that you hold dear, besides all these other fantastic stories that we've talked about?
But my kind of favorite story, and it sums up the whole of Alien, really, on the first day of the shooting, he was shooting the empty craft going round.
Mm-hmm.
The camera was just drifting. And he came across into the bridge area, and he said, what should be happening, the papers should be fluttering in the air conditioning. So could we do this? So again, I saw the hairdresser, and I said, give me a hairdryer. I got under the set in terrible. I was being bitten by wood and structures, and I got right under there, and I said, Ridley, wash the papers, and I blew the papers until they just looked like air conditioning. He said, that's it, I'll shoot.
Wow.
That's really, in a way, that sums it up, the whole shooting of Alien, how it was.
Again, just what can we do that will be organic and that we have access to? And you just pulled a hairdryer and made that whole scene work. It really
Doesn't cost any money.
Yeah. That is so awesome, Roger.
One last thing. They cancelled Fox when they cut the 600,000 out. You know, that's in all the books. They were fighting to cancel the big pilot set. Ridley said, we have to have it. So that was
the
only
space
built
jockey?
Half of it on a turntable. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That was supposed to come out. Ridley says, you need the scale. I have to have it. So they found a way, Nick Alder and Michael Seymour, to put the space jockey on a turntable and then only build one side of the set so he could turn the space jockey around and shoot all the reverses. So that solved that.
Oh.
But what went out was the waking up when the canopies rise and the crew wakes up. That set gone. They said, no, you can't afford it.
Oh,
and the head of Fox, yeah, he went down and said, pull this set down now. It was being built, and it got pulled down. And so Ridley said, what can we do? And we had a Spanish art director, and I said, Benjamin, can you convert one of the other sets like this on secret? So he said, okay. I went to Nick Alder. He had six of those fighter plexiglass cockpits. They're like glass.
Oh.
He had six bows. He said, I'm not using. And he said, and I've got six pistons. So we got all of those built in, and we built the set without Fox knowing.
Whoa. So it was built in secret. Oh, my gosh.
They never knew that was built on the thing. And it got scheduled and somehow shot.
They probably didn't have anything to say when they saw it. They were probably like, this is great.
Yes. So, yeah, I think, you know, once the success comes, then everything is fine.
Wow. If there's a will, there's a way.
Well, that's the thing. That was always my mantra, you know, you never give up. And it was taught to me by the first job I ever had as a T-boy, by John Box. John Box, my film that made me want to become into the film industry was Dr. Zhivago. It blew me away. And I, by sheer fluke, and I would tell the story now, it's a long story, but by sheer fluke, I ended up as, he gave me my first job, John Box. And he'd opened up my folder and said, look, I'll take you on, but you have to make the tea. And I said, it's fine. I'll make as much tea as you want all day long. I don't care. I just want to work. And he said, good. Then he closed all my work. I'd done 3 years at art school, 2 years at architecture school. I had all this stuff, you know, and he closed up and said, forget all of this. You're in the desert. You've got a bottle of green ink in your pocket and an aeroplane next to you and a cloud of dust. Out gets the director and the producer, and they look at it and say, this is fantastic. Can you do it red by tomorrow morning? And he said, you're in the desert. There's two things. You do it, or you talk your way out of it on the spot with an alternative. That's the film industry, Roger. And it stayed with me forever.
That's so great. That's a great analogy for what it is.
It is. Yeah.
Well, Roger, I have one more question for you, and it's a question I ask all of our Class of 79 graduates, and that's if you could go back in time 40 years ago, what advice would you give yourself, either in relation to your work on Alien or just in life in general?
I think it's to embrace the moment and enjoy it. And we had to do that on Star Wars, and I had to do it on Alien, because literally I didn't have a day off in almost a year on Star Wars, and I worked from morning till night, 7 days a week, and it was the same on Alien. See, you're living in a moment. It's just, that's all there is. And I think, you know, to take grasp of the day-to-day and to believe in your dreams, because I did, you know, and everyone was talking me out of everything. You can't do that. You can't do this. And I said, but I think I can. And I think that when your dreams and your aspirations are based on something that you really know deeply, it's not like, oh, I can make this fly, you know, and you can't.
Right.
But when you have a real instinct, and that's what I've learned much more so since then, is to trust the instinct and to develop it, because that's where stories are based on. That's where the great work is based on. It comes from somehow inside. And I think one has to learn how to channel that. It's basically finding yourself. You have to find yourself and your voice. And this is always the hardest thing, because human beings work on a negative. I don't know why. You look at the internet now, everything is negative. People slagging this, slagging that. They all have a voice. You have to somehow get rid of that and work on a positive and believe.
And you're right. Enjoy the moment. Even if, you know, you're thinking about where you want to be and you're not really there yet, if you just enjoy, you know, the process and, you know that you'll get there, then I think you'll be happier overall. I really do. Well, thank you, Roger, so much for joining us to share your memories of your time working on Alien. We're just so thankful for the film and for you and your involvement in it. And thank you so much for taking the time today.
Not at all. I enjoy it.
Hey, Ripley.
Right here.
We're clean. Let us in.
What happened to Kane?
Something has attached itself to him. We have to get him to the infirmary right away.
What kind of thing? I need a clear definition.
An organism. Open the hatch.
Wait a minute. If we let it in, the ship could be infected. You know the quarantine procedure.
24 hours for decontamination.
He could die in 24 hours. Open the hatch.
Listen to me. If we break quarantine, we could all die.
Look, could you open the goddamn hatch? We have to get him inside.
Thanks for listening to Fangoria Presents Class of 79. We really appreciate you tuning in. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd love it if you would rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. And follow Fangoria on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the horror content you crave. Class of 79 is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, produced and hosted by Natasha Pasetta, executive producers Dallas Sonier and Phil Nobile Jr., associate producer Jessica Safavimer, art and design by Ashley Detmering, sound recording, design, and mixing by Natasha Pasetta, music by James Malone, for Fangoria, Brandon Wynerdy, Jason Koslerich, Rachel Wilson, and special thanks to Udo Kier.